76ers, who at the time were coached by Billy Cunningham, one of Smith's former stars. The Sixers told Smith that if they were able to get the second or third pick in the draft, they would select Jordan. But while Cunningham loved Jordan, owner Harold Katz seemed intent on taking Charles Barkley, former Sixers coach Matt Gukas revealed in a 2012 interview. Regardless, Jordan's decision to leave college early added momentum to Vaccaro's plan to build a product line around him. Rob Strasser and Peter Moore, Nike's creative designer, met with Falk in Washington, D.C. in August 1984. By that time, Falk had put together a list of ideas for the name of Jordan's shoes and gear. On the list was the name Air Jordan. Strasser and Moore fixed on it immediately. "That's it," Moore said. "Air Jordan." By the end of their meeting, Moore had already sketched out the logo, complete with a badge with wings around a basketball and the words Air Jordan. Meanwhile, Vaccaro still had to persuade reclusive Nike chairman Phil Knight that making such an extravagant offer to a young, relatively unknown and untested NBA rookie was a good idea. He set up a dinner meeting with Knight during the Olympics in Los Angeles and invited Billy Packer to come along, ostensibly to help sell Knight on the idea. Knight, a former Miler, founded Nike along with Bill Bowerman, the legendary track coach at the University of Oregon. Knight allowed extroverts like Rob Strasser to conduct much of the day-to-day operations of Nike. The big decisions and strategies, however, still required his blessing. Knight was acutely aware that Vaccaro had built relationships that paid off in huge sales growth for Nike. In fact, the Sporting News would soon include Knight and Vaccaro on their list of the 100 most powerful people in sports. Over dinner, Vaccaro talked at length about the young player named Jordan, Packer remembered. Knight was very noncommittal. He asked a lot of questions, but was noncommittal. There was no, "Boy, Sonny, I hope you can get him." I didn't know if that was just Phil Knight's demeanor or what, but it wasn't like he was gushing or saying, "Geez, is there any way we can help you? We've got to have this guy." It wasn't that at all. It was very businesslike, very calm. And Sonny was going on as to why he thought Michael would be this great marketing item. Even at the Olympics, it was obvious there was still a lot of selling to be done for Michael to be a commodity for Nike. Meanwhile, Strasser and Vaccaro also still had to sell the Jordans on the idea of Nike. Michael would later admit that at age 21, he was still quite immature and really didn't know or care much about the business of shoes. But Vaccaro turned to his old friend George Raveling, an assistant coach on Bobby Knight's Olympic team, to help bridge the gap to Jordan. Raveling introduced Jordan to Vaccaro in Los Angeles during the games. "It was at Tony Roma's, and George brought Michael over there and introduced me," Vaccaro recalled. "That's the first time in my life I'd ever met Michael. We sat down and talked about his going to Nike. He didn't even know about Nike. You have to understand that. And I told him, 'Michael, you don't know me, but we're going to build a shoe for you. No one has this shoe.'" It was not a great first impression from either perspective. Jordan thought Vaccaro seemed shady. Vaccaro considered Jordan something of a brat. That became obvious when Jordan seemed to ignore the talk about the product line to ask Vaccaro for a car. "If you take this deal, you can buy any car you want," Vaccaro told him. "I want a car," Jordan emphasized. Michael was a pain in the ass, he was, Vaccaro recalled. First of all, he didn't compute the money. Second of all, he was still a kid, this guy coming out of North Carolina. Whatever, a shoe contract meant nothing back in the 80s. So he was totally indifferent. He didn't want to come with us. He wanted to go with Adidas. In the 80s, Adidas had the nicest sweatsuits. Jordan did ask about money, and Vaccaro told him not to sweat it. If the deal came together, Jordan would be a millionaire. Jordan's main interest continued to be a new car. Vaccaro came to understand that if the car was what snared Jordan, then he needed to produce a car. "We'll get you a car," he promised. Jordan smiled, but that did nothing to reassure Vaccaro. "You know Michael's got that smile," he said. "He looks at you. It's a very tricky smile. You never know what that smile means." The Nike contingent knew that Falk was also talking to Adidas and Converse, but Strasser's relationship with Falk kept them confident. That September, the agent was wrapping up Jordan's contract with the Bulls. Plus, Nike knew its plan for Jordan went far beyond what Adidas or Converse contemplated. Vaccaro and Strasser felt sure that Jordan would realize what an incredible deal he was being offered. The day after Team USA won the gold, Falk, Strasser, and Vaccaro sat down to negotiate the scope of the Jordan deal. Indeed, Nike threw its entire budget at Jordan, a $2.5 million package over 5 years, a combination of guarantees, a signing bonus, and annuities. Nike also agreed to a major commitment to advertise Air Jordan. In terms of pro basketball shoe deals, the agreement was unprecedented due to the 25% royalty Jordan would get on each Air Jordan shoe sold. He would also get royalties on Nike Air shoes. Truth be told, Falk could have perhaps gotten as much as 50% on the royalty for Jordan, Vaccaro said in 2012. David wanted more cash up front. In 1984, there was no guarantee any of these shoes were going to sell. Nonetheless, the deal represented an enormous gamble. After all, Jordan was headed to a poorly managed team in a league that was still under the long shadow of its partying and cocaine-abusing culture of the 1970s. The Bulls team that had just signed Jordan featured several players who had deeply invested in the idea that things go better with coke. If Nike had done a formal risk assessment, it might well have been enough to kill the deal. However, this was not about business plans. It was about Sonny Vaccaro's hunch. The night before Jordan and his parents were to fly to Oregon to hear Nike officials present their vision for the Air Jordan campaign, Jordan phoned his parents and told them he wasn't going. He was tired of all his recent travels, and the last thing he wanted was a cross-country trip for a shoe he didn't even like. Dolores Jordan insisted that her son be at the airport in the morning. She would have it no other way. Sure enough, Jordan was at the Raleigh-Durham airport early the next day. Strasser, Vaccaro, and all the Nike people were there at the meeting. Among them was Howard White, the former University of Maryland basketball player who would play a role in the company's long-term relationship with Jordan. Phil Knight even dropped in, a rare thing for the chairman. Vaccaro and the other Nike representatives were immediately struck by Dolores Jordan's focus and professionalism. "I can tell you, she is one of the most impressive people I've met in my life," Vaccaro said, "because she was able to negotiate this life for her son." Jordan sat expressionless during the presentation, as if he didn't care. He didn't want to be there and was determined not to be impressed. He looked at the red and black shoes and commented that red was the devil's color. Too bad, he added, that he wasn't still at Carolina. That way the shoes could be swathed in blue heaven. Despite Michael's attitude, Vaccaro couldn't take his eyes off Dolores Jordan. He watched her expression as it was explained that her son would receive royalties on each shoe sold. Vaccaro told the Jordans that Nike was all in for its commitment. "I said it, and I'm so glad I said it," he recalled. "We're all in. I was betting my job. Nike was betting their future. It was unbelievable. That was our whole budget. For Michael's mother, it was like a family if we were willing to bet it. It was like we were saying, we wanted you this much. It was like, you're going to make my son the future of this company. Like we said, Michael, we're going to go broke if you bust out. That's basically what I was saying. That was the whole point of it." What wasn't articulated was the key thought on the minds of everyone in the room. This was not just an unprecedented offering in terms of finance. It was that this pot of gold was being offered to a 21-year-old African-American who had never played a minute of professional basketball. America had witnessed the emergence of a progression of iconic black athletes, from Jackie Robinson to Willie Mays to Bill Russell to Wilt Chamberlain to Jim Brown to Muhammad Ali. They had made their way through the gauntlet of the nation's civil rights struggle. At no point had Madison Avenue perceived any one of these men as a suitable candidate to be the centerpiece of the kind of campaign that Nike envisioned for young Michael Jordan. Timing was truly everything. Though the matter was far from settled, Vaccaro gained confidence from the look that crossed Mrs. Jordan's face. It was Dolores's reaction, he recalled. Someone was making them a partner instead of paying them a wage. And she loved that. This woman was everything. Michael loved his father, he did, but Dolores ran the show. It would not immediately be recognized as such, but the meeting marked a black power moment, although it was not the black power born of protest against social injustice and racial prejudice. The black power represented by Dolores Jordan had come straight from the coastal plain of North Carolina, where blacks had been violently barred from politics and society. The black power she knew came from her father, and it was based in the economic realities of sharecropping and tenant farming. It was an economic black power, and it was arguably the greatest power that blacks possessed, marked by the black-owned banks and small businesses that had come to thrive during segregation in cities such as Atlanta and Durham. The often anonymous economic gains of black professionals and entrepreneurs may not have been highly publicized, but that accumulated wealth sat at the heart of the African-American experience. Those first Nike negotiations would bring Michael Jordan the beginnings of a life-changing economic power. Before that could happen, however, the Nike executives and Dolores Jordan would have to persuade her somewhat petulant son that the deal was in his best interest. His immediate response had been the stone face. Then he looked at Vaccaro and asked again about a car. Vaccaro pulled two miniature toy cars out of his pocket and rolled them across the table at Jordan. Years later, Vaccaro was pretty sure one of them was a Lamborghini. "They're your cars, Michael," Vaccaro replied. He then reiterated that the deal would enable Jordan to buy whatever cars he wanted. In fact, Jordan was set to be paid more by the shoe company than by the Bulls. Everyone in the room seemed to smile, except Jordan himself. Phil Knight quipped that the company was buying Jordan cars even before he had agreed to the deal. Then the chairman excused himself from the room. "Michael, at some point in time you have to trust people," Vaccaro recalled telling Jordan. "Now in those words what I said was, and he knew it for a fact, we're betting as much on you as you're betting on us." As the meeting concluded, the Nike contingent had no idea how Jordan felt about the presentation. Afterward, he told Falk he was simply fed up with meetings. It wasn't until later that night at dinner with his parents, Strasser, and other Nike officials that Jordan began to relax. The young star was impressive that evening, gracious and charming, able to move among the clientele in the upscale restaurant with ease. His persona that night reassured the Nike executives that they were making a wise choice, that indeed this young man had that certain special something, an ability to connect with people of all backgrounds. The term post-racial hadn't entered the vocabulary yet, but it could have described what they sensed about Jordan. After dinner, they had prepared a highlight reel of Jordan's great moments at North Carolina for his viewing on the VCR in the limo on the way back to their hotel. It was the perfect touch. He also took a second look at the video of the Air Jordan line that could be his. The deal had not been closed, but bonds had been formed, impressions made. "He listened to her," Vaccaro said of Jordan and his mother. "She was the deciding vote. She told him, they want us as a partner. She convinced him. She did. I'll never forget that day." Falk dutifully went to Converse and Adidas to see what they had to offer. Jordan even approached a Converse rep that he knew, telling the rep that his company just had to get close to the Nike offer. Neither Converse nor Adidas was prepared to offer anything near the treatment that Sonny Vaccaro had envisioned for Michael Jordan. Phil Knight supposedly never officially sanctioned or gave his approval to the deal, but he didn't move to stop it either, as Rob Strasser seized on Vaccaro's idea and made it happen. As a result, Knight's silence became his tacit approval. "Phil Knight listened to a guy like Sonny and bought into it," Packer said. "Whatever they paid Sonny, it was way below whatever he did for them. He had great vision, and one of his greatest visions, obviously, is that Michael would not only be this kind of player, but would be this magnetic personality that could sell sneakers and anything else." Nike officials didn't realize it at the time, but they had just taken the first irrevocable step in making Michael Jordan a full partner in the company. "He's as much an image as he is a symbol," David Falk said that fall, after revealing that Jordan had signed deals with Nike, Wilson Sporting Goods, and the Chicagoland Chevrolet Dealerships Association. The Nike deal in particular sent gasps of surprise and resentment across pro basketball. Jordan himself sensed it before he had encountered a single opponent. Yet, as young as he was, he had no idea of its proportions. "I know everybody's eyes are on me," he said as he headed into his rookie season, "and some of the things I do even surprise myself. They aren't always planned, they just happen." Meanwhile, Sonny Vaccaro rejoiced at the realization that his grandest idea was about to take flight. "We could have gone under if he had been a failure," Vaccaro said 3 decades later, looking back. "We put all the money we had into him. What if he'd been an average player? Nobody knew for sure at the time. We'd have been embarrassed. I mean, I don't know what would have happened. But I do know what didn't happen. He wasn't an average player. He was someone who crossed over and made millions of dollars." Chapter 16. The First Look. Jordan returned home in late August for yet another ceremony honoring his achievements, this time at Wilmington's Thelean Hall, where he formally presented his mother with his Olympic gold medal. Laney High also used the occasion to retire Jordan's number 23 Buccaneers jersey. A month later, he made the trip to Chicago for the opening of training camp. He had assumed that his life as a Chicago Bull would be very different from his days as a North Carolina Tar Heel. Even so, he had no idea how dramatic the difference would be. It began with coaching. No longer was he bound by the dictates of Dean Smith or Bobby Knight. His new coach was 44-year-old Kevin Loughery, a flamboyant byproduct of the madcap age of pro basketball in the 60s and 70s, when he had starred for the old Baltimore Bullets. Loughery had a thick Brooklyn accent and a lopsided grin that matched his mirthful approach to the game. "Kevin was from the old school," recalled former Bulls trainer Mark Phil. "At the time, guys were still having fun in pro basketball. You come in, do your work, then get together afterwards and hit the bars and have some fun." Loughery had an intuitive feel for basketball. He had played well in the pros, averaging 15.3 points per game over 12 NBA seasons. He appealed immediately to Jordan because he had coached Julius Erving and the New York Nets to two American Basketball Association titles. As a player, Loughery had defended Jerry West in the 1965 Eastern Conference Finals when West was tearing through records with a string of 40-point games. Between his experiences with West and Erving, Loughery was a man who understood that superior athletic talent dictates its own agenda. Under Loughery, the team's young star was going to get the ball as often as possible. Jordan would say many times that Loughery was by far the most fun of the coaches he played for. "He gave me the confidence to play on his level," Jordan later explained. "My first year, he threw me the ball and said, 'Hey kid, I know you can play, go play.' I don't think that would have been the case going through another coach's system." Suddenly, the Jordan on the floor appeared a lot like the gums-bared, high-flying specter who had haunted Laney's gym in high school, albeit with a more developed physique and a much more polished game. There was no hiding the athleticism now. Loughery made the year about Jordan finding his identity and his confidence as a player. The coach allowed Jordan to discover his game on his own, rather than trying to impose it on him. He recognized Jordan's great hunger and realized that it was his job to feed it. Where Dean Smith's system and even Bobby Knight's system had confined his development, Loughery wanted to give Jordan the freedom he needed to explore it. It helped that Loughery's base of power with the Bulls was GM Rod Thorne, who had been his assistant with the Nets and had full confidence in his coaching. Just as important was Loughery's personal relationship with his young star. "I could relate with him as a friend," Jordan explained. Loughery had been in the same position himself and understood the challenges the rookie would face, including his new teammates. Unlike the motivated young All-Americans at UNC, Jordan would now be working with an array of cynical cast-offs and casualties, some of them deeply troubled by cocaine and alcohol abuse. Talented guard Quentin Daly was in the midst of a very public breakdown in Chicago, which had begun well before Jordan arrived. "Q was a good friend," recalled trainer Mark Phil. "I felt bad for him. We would try to threaten him, but how do you threaten somebody who came from nothing?" He said, "I'm going to end up on the street. I've been on the street. I survive on the street. You can't threaten me with that." Also beginning his descent into alcohol and cocaine abuse was the team's other immensely talented player, Orlando Wooldridge, a second-year forward out of Notre Dame. Ultimately, both teammates were following a sad trail to an early grave. The roster was full of troubled souls. As Bulls PR man Tim Hallam explained, Jordan was much too competitive to pay mind to either drugs or alcohol. That would have meant exposing a weakness to an opponent, something Jordan would never do. Journeyman Rod Higgins, one of the few stable personalities on the team, was 3 years older than Jordan. Amidst the chaos that season, they formed a fast friendship, one that would last far beyond their playing days. 6 years later, Jordan would look back and comment that of all his teammates, those on that first team were the most physically gifted and also the most clueless. Looney Tunes, he called them. The Bulls' practice facility at Angel Guardian Gym appeared no more conducive to success than Jordan's troubling new teammates. "It was kind of a dark, gloomy gym with a real hard floor," explained Tim Hallam. "There were no frills there. You parked your car in the grass in the back. They had one little sidewalk where the players were allowed to pull their car up on the sidewalk, and then they had to pull off in the grass. It had an antiquated locker room. There was no food. You know, there were no amenities at all whatsoever." And Angel Guardian was always filled with little ones, the Bulls' longtime ticket manager Joe O'Neill recalled. The team had to wait in line for the third graders to get off the court, literally, so the Bulls could practice. The players would be lined up, and there would be a line of kids across the hall going to the pool or going to the gym. The place was also just plain cold, offering little respite from Chicago's notorious weather, recalled former Bulls guard John Paxson. As he had in Venezuela during the Pan Am Games, Jordan placed absolutely no importance on the circumstances. Angel Guardian was every bit as good as the outdoor court at MP Park or the many other places he had played growing up, so he simply shrugged and went to work. For those first weeks, the Bulls housed their new rookie at the Lincoln Hyatt House, not far from Angel Guardian. When Jordan had landed at O'Hare a few days before training camp, he was greeted by a 29-year-old limo driver named George Kohler, who had just missed one fare and was looking to pick up another. He had seen the skinny young rookie, mistakenly called him Larry Jordan, and offered to take him anywhere in the city for $25. "Do you know my brother?" Jordan had asked, tilting a confused eye at the driver. Nonetheless, it would be the beginning of a beautiful relationship. Kohler would later become Jordan's regular driver, then his personal assistant and lifelong friend. He remembered a Jordan that first day who was green and unsure of himself in the big city. I looked in the rearview mirror and I couldn't even see him because he was scrunched down like a little kid, Kohler recalled. I don't know if he'd been in a stretch limo before. He didn't know anyone in Chicago. I was a stranger and he was obviously a bit nervous that I could drop him off in an alley somewhere. Jordan soon found his bearings. He came to practice every day like it was Game 7 of the NBA Finals, Joe O'Neill recalled with a laugh. He would destroy you in practice. That's what set the tone for our team. Loughery had watched Jordan from afar, but the impact up close was far more dramatic. When we started doing one-on-one drills, the coach recalled, we immediately seen that we had a star. I can't say that we knew we had the best player ever in basketball, but we always felt that Michael could shoot the ball. A lot of people had questioned that, but Michael had played in a passing game system in college under Dean Smith and in the Olympics under Bobby Knight, so people never got the opportunity to see him handle the ball individually the way he could handle it. Then, when we found out how supremely competitive he was, we knew we had a player who had it all. Bill Blair, Loughery's assistant, recalled that the coaches decided to have a scrimmage on the second day of practice to check out Jordan's skills in the open court. Michael took the ball off the rim at one end, Blair said, and went to the other end. From the top of the key, he soared in and dunked it, and Kevin says, we don't have to scrimmage anymore. His anticipation was so great, he could see the floor and his quickness and then his strength, Loughery recalled. That's another thing that was overlooked, how strong Michael was. He really had the whole package. Yet from the start, Jordan remained focused not on what he had, but on what he didn't have. There's no doubt I'm playing a new, tougher level, he said after his first pro practice. I've got a lot to learn. You knew you had somebody special because Michael was always there at practice 45 minutes early, Blair recalled. He wanted to work on his shooting, and after practice he'd make you help him. He'd keep working on his shooting. He didn't care how long he was out there. The thing that I always loved about him, when you'd take him out in practice to give him a rest during a scrimmage, he was constantly back on you to get him back in. Michael loved to play the game. Secretariat. The media contingent covering Jordan's first day of training camp consisted of exactly one newspaper reporter, one magazine writer, four photographers, and a TV crew. Sure, the Cubs were bringing a storybook season to a close that weekend, and the Bears faced Dallas at Soldier Field that Sunday, but the cold truth was that no one in Chicago cared much about the Bulls in September 1984. Michael Jordan or no Michael Jordan. The Bulls were the poorest child in town, explained Jeff Davis, who in those days was a sports television producer in the Second City. It wasn't just Chicago. The NBA didn't care much either. The league had a new television contract with CBS Sports that season and hadn't included a single Bulls appearance on the schedule. Even the local stations weren't interested in shooting footage of the Bulls for their newscasts, Davis explained. TV rarely came around in those days. If a camera crew did show up at Angel Guardian, Loughery paid it no mind. There were no media restrictions involving the team's practices. Jeff Davis would go just because he was a basketball fan, he recalled. I'll never forget seeing those practices early that year. Good grief, there was an intensity in Jordan that was unlike any other player who'd come along, because he was so talented. You could see that he was such a hard worker, and you knew he was going to do things. He'd take it to the rack with such ease against everybody. He was demanding. He wanted defenders to stick to him. Tighter, come on, defend me, damn you, he'd call out names. He was a trash-talking son of a gun, too. Michael would pick on somebody every day, trainer Mark Phil remembered. You saw this early on. Every day, somebody was going to be his goat. It would be anybody on the team. Guys like Enes Watley and Ronnie Lester and Quinton Daly. Michael would shoot, stick it in their faces time and time again. He used to get their goats to make them play harder, mainly because he was so competitive. There were times during his rookie year when practice was unworkable. Loughery would just toss up his hands and let Michael do his thing. It's interesting when you have a rookie who comes in like Michael did, Rod Higgins recalled in 2012. Instantaneously, he got respect from the veterans because of his competitiveness. When we started out in that training camp, I noticed that this kid would embarrass you if you didn't bring your level of play up. He didn't really care who the veteran was that was guarding him either. Michael is like Secretariat, assistant coach Fred Carter quipped early that year. All the other horses know they have to run to keep up with him. In practice, Loughery used to put Michael with different teams just to see what he could do, Rod Thorne said. Whatever team Kevin put him on, that team would win. Kevin told me, I don't know if our other guys are that bad or he's that good. Kevin always had a thing in practice, Phil recalled, where he'd divide the roster into two teams and the first team to 10 won. The team that lost ran 10 laps. Kevin called it 10 points or 10 laps. Michael never ran a lap the whole year. One time Michael's team was up 8-0, and Kevin switched him to the other team. Michael was furious. He scored the first 9 points by himself, and his team won. Once I saw him in camp, I changed my thinking about what we were going to do offensively, Loughery recalled. He dictated what type of offense we were going to need. We weren't a very strong roster outside of Michael, so he was going to have to do a lot of shooting. I immediately started thinking of ways to isolate him, of having him go one-on-one. It made sense to post him up because he was stronger than most guards. You had to gear your offense around him. Jordan had hoped to play off guard with the idea that he could match up against smaller opponents. Loughery took this notion one step further, however, to the idea that this rookie could really create mismatches at the point. Actually, he could also play small forward. The versatility essentially meant that the Bulls had gotten an upgrade at three positions. The team headed out to play a quick run of exhibition games before the season. The era opened in Peoria at the Civic Center in front of 2,500 fans with Jordan on the bench. He came on to score a game-high 18. The schedule also took the Bulls to Glens Falls, New York, where Jordan dunked freely during warm-ups to the delight of the crowd, which cheered him right up until the moment it became clear that Jordan was going to defeat their Knicks that night. Tim Hallam first recognized something different about the fan connection to Jordan in an exhibition stop in upstate Indiana. He scored 40 points that night, and afterward a string of fans, many of them young boys, followed him down the hallway, like Jordan was their Pied Piper. This magnetism became more apparent with each passing day. In the future, it would become necessary to wall him off, to protect him from the unharnessed power of that affection. But constructing that wall would take months. In the early days of that season, his growing public was merely amusing. From the reaction of his coaches and teammates in that first training camp to the fan interest he generated during exhibition season, Jordan had reinforced the idea that he could turn the franchise around. "We saw his skills," Loughery recalled, "but you've got to be around him every day to see the competitiveness of the guy. He was going to try to take over every situation that was difficult. He was going to put himself on the line. He enjoyed it." The franchise needed all that their new rookie had to offer. The first time they attended a Bulls game in Chicago Stadium, James and Dolores Jordan were taken aback by the sparse attendance and the dead atmosphere. Compared to the intense basketball energy at the University of North Carolina, Bulls games seemed pathetic. The Jordans wondered how this team could afford to pay their son hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. "This will get better," Dolores told her husband, but she was far from sure. The negativity began with the stadium itself, the Madhouse on Madison, which sat in the middle of one of Chicago's worst neighborhoods. The area had been hit hard during the Chicago riot of 1968, following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the decade and a half since, conditions on much of the west side had grown utterly bleak. For any fans brave enough to attend a Bulls game, parking their cars and finding their way to the gate often produced a heart-in-throat experience. "You had kids that would say, 'Can I wash your car, mister?'" Jeff Davis recalled. "If you parked on the street, and if you didn't give them a little folding cash, you'd get your tires slashed. That was not uncommon. If you were there with the media, you were told, 'Do not park anywhere but in the team-sanctioned parking lots, and get out of there as fast as you can after the games.' So you had a mass exodus within a half hour, 45 minutes from that place. People did not linger around the arena afterwards." "The Bulls were struggling at that time, and the stadium was on the west side," explained Tim Hallam. "Back then, it didn't look the way it does now, with all the economic development. It was the second oldest building in the league behind the Boston Garden. You know, it was a great place when it was packed. It was loud. The noise was contained because it would bounce off the roof and come back. There weren't any acoustics, which was good for a loud crowd, but we weren't drawing huge crowds at the time, so it was mostly dead." "We still had a very small season ticket base," Joe O'Neill admitted. "In the third quarter, I could count the attendance. I just go out and count the fans." Steve Shanwald, who would eventually become the Bulls' VP, had come to Chicago in 1981 as a marketing executive for the White Sox. A University of Maryland grad, he had loved the enthusiasm of ACC basketball and made a point to take in a few Bulls games. He'd been shocked as well. "The stadium was a dead building for basketball," Shanwald recalled. "I used to enjoy coming out because I could get a seat and stretch out, but it was really kind of an embarrassment to see. I couldn't believe this was NBA basketball. It seemed more like the CBA or worse. The stadium itself was always great when it was filled with people. When it was devoid of people, it was kind of a depressing setting, like a tomb. There was no glitzy scoreboard. I am told that in the early days, Bulls fans used to watch basketball games through the hockey plexiglass. That's how little respect the Bulls had." That sparse atmosphere only multiplied Jordan's difficulty on opening night. He was trying to juggle two female guests without them finding out about each other. He had been in the city for just a month, his mother living with him for much of that time, no less, and yet, on his guest list for opening night, he had included comp tickets for two women and was scrambling just before game time to make sure they were seated in different sections of the arena. Best to have them in opposite corners so he could keep things straight, he reasoned. Of course, typical of a rookie, he undercut his own furtive efforts at manipulating the seating arrangement that night by tipping off a reporter. In time, he would become more mindful of what he said within earshot of the media. Still, he had obviously come a long way since the days in high school when he had struggled to find a date. After hitting the shot to beat Georgetown in 1982, he and roommate Buzz Peterson had soon discovered they had a skyrocketing popularity with the female population in Chapel Hill. Jordan had found an even larger and more active social life in Chicago, one that had been pioneered by former Bull Reggie Theus, who had cut such a dashing party figure downtown that he had come to be called Rush Street Reggie. Theus's departure in 1983 had left an opening for the rookie Jordan to fill as Chicago's premier ladies' man. Jordan was serious about basketball, but not so serious as to pass up opportunity. At Carolina, his fame had been the big appeal. Now in Chicago, he was discovering that fortune was even more alluring. The beginning. At age 21, Jordan was bursting with anticipation to play that first game on Friday, October 26, 1984, against the Washington Bullets in the creaky old stadium. There were none of the laser shows that marked his pregame introductions later. Instead, he came onto the court that first time accompanied only by the strains of Michael Jackson's Thriller. The 13,913 fans, about 6,000 more than the Bulls' opening night a year earlier, cheered loudly to greet him and erupted each time he did something to change the flow of the game. It became clear that very first quarter the Bulls' games would no longer be known as sleepy little affairs. 21 seconds into the action, he missed his first shot, an 18-footer. A minute later, he stole the ball from Washington guard Frank Johnson to register his first steal. The game was only minutes old when he drew the crowd's first gasp after he took off from the left for a slam over the top of brawny Bullet center Jeff Ruland, who shrugged off the intrusion and knocked him to the floor. The stadium grew quiet as Jordan lay motionless. Finally, he got up and later complained of a sore neck and head. He and Ruland agreed afterward that the collision was inadvertent, but it would signal an early pattern, Jordan reaching through the trees to attack the rim and the trees having something to say about it. At the 7:27 mark of the opening period, he scored his first NBA bucket, a 12-foot bank shot from the right side of the lane. From there, his nervousness made for an uneven shooting night. He made just 5 of 16 shots from the floor, scored 16 points, and had 7 assists and 6 rebounds. He also had 5 turnovers to go with the 9 missed shots. Yet there had been much for fans to delight in. "This was a good start for my career," he said afterward. "My main concern was to get everybody going tonight. First I figure you keep hustling, then you get the big guys going, then everything falls in place. Certainly one thing would change. In that first game, the ball seemed to spend much of the night in the hands of his teammates." The coaching staff got another eyeful at the second game in Milwaukee, assistant Bill Blair recalled. When he started abusing Sidney Moncrief, who we considered one of the top 5 defensive guards in the league, we knew that we had a special person. In his third game, also against the Bucks, he scored 37 points, including 22 in the fourth quarter, as 9,356 fans in the stadium saw the Bulls claim a come-from-behind win over Milwaukee. As the games melted away, Jordan found a ball in his hands more and more. Eager not to disappoint, the rookie would race up and down the floor, tongue out tasting the air. He was blindingly quick to the ball, taking rebounds and breaking into the open court like a scat back heading to daylight. Because he could cross the ball over while going full speed up court, opponents learned to step up to cut off the crossover, only to find that he was ready with a buttery reverse pivot that he could likewise execute at full speed. Such moves were difficult even for waterbug guards, but to have someone 6'6 doing them? If opponents hesitated about getting back on defense, he was gone. And if they did get back to protect the rim, Jordan presented a new sort of challenge. Time and again, he left the tarmac early and flew toward the goal, taking time to decide just how he was going to finish. Elgin Baylor had first shown the league hang time in the late 1950s, and Julius Erving later added a certain poetry. But this Jordan glide to the stuff proved spellbinding. There seemed to be a calm that settled on him as he closed in, tongue out, surveying the defensive landscape. Now he could cradle the ball and contemplate his moves without worrying about what his coach was thinking. With all his spectacular dunking, observers hardly mentioned his stupendous ability to measure the reverse. If the defender had position and went for the principle of verticality, Jordan simply floated around that and flipped the ball in from the backside. Once Michael started playing and playing well, the fans got interested, Rod Thorne remembered. At the start of the season, we were selling in the 6,000 range. Then, all of a sudden, we were up over 10,000. He was a show. Consistent sellouts would take a while longer, but the business model for the Chicago Bulls had clearly gotten an upgrade. Now that Jordan had turned his youthful fire on opponents, conflicts arose with a variety of earthbound defenders. In his early games, this guy was going to the basket every time he had the ball, Thorne explained. He was putting up dunks and whirligig shots. Players and other teams were knocking him down out of the air. We pretty soon realized he was going to get killed. In his first game against the Pistons, Jordan was floating up for a dunk when Detroit center Bill Laimbeer slammed him to the floor, creating an uproar in the stadium. He needed a protector on his team, yet none emerged immediately. Chicago's early victories did get Quentin Daly and others to crowing about how they couldn't wait for the early visit of the defending champion Boston Celtics. Jordan scored 27 against Larry Bird and company, but the Celtics won handily, having been fired up by reading aloud the Bulls' boasting. Still, Bird was impressed. "I've never seen any one player turn a team around like that," he told Trib columnist Bob Verdi afterward. "All the Bulls have become better because of him. Pretty soon this place will be packed every night. They'll pay just to watch Jordan. He's the best. Even at this stage in his career, he's doing more than I ever did. I couldn't do what he does as a rookie. Heck, there was one drive tonight, he had the ball up in his right hand, then he took it down, then he brought it back up. I got a hand on it, fouled him, and he still scored. All the while, he's in the air. You have to play this game to know how difficult that is. You see that and say, well, what the heck can you do? I'd seen a little of him before and wasn't that impressed. I mean, I thought he'd be good, but not this good. Ain't nothing he can't do. That's good for this franchise, good for the league. The scouting report said, play me for the drive, that I couldn't go left, Jordan recalled. They didn't know about my first step or the moves or the jump. I knew I was taking everybody by surprise, including myself. Having sensed this impending stardom, Loughery quickly set up an all-Jordan, all-the-time offense, Tim Hallam recalled. Kevin was one of those coaches where, how do you describe it? It's kind of like, if you've got a horse, he's going to ride it, you know. And that was certainly the case here with Michael. That trust between the two built from game to game as Jordan grew comfortable with Loughery's style, Hallam said. Kevin was a good coach, a great situational coach. He was a tactician back then. Michael respected that. Jordan's presence, of course, seemed to answer just about all tactical questions. In just his ninth pro game, he scored 45 points against San Antonio. 6 weeks later, he burned Cleveland for another 45. Then came a 42-point performance against New York, and another 45 against Atlanta. The energy level was almost unnerving, recalled Doc Rivers, the Atlanta Hawks' veteran point guard at the time. I remember the first year saying to the guys in the locker room, there's no way that guy will be able to play with that energy for an entire season. Indeed, NBA rookies traditionally hit the wall. They would play 25 games or so, the length of a college season, and discover their legs gone, their bodies worn down. Not Jordan. 2 years later, he was still doing the same thing, Rivers marveled. His intelligence always stood out, but with MJ, his intensity always stood out even more. There are very few who have that. It's rare to see a superstar with that level of intensity who can still do it every night, who is a target every night. It was amazing. His first triple-double, 35 points, 15 assists, and 14 rebounds, came against Denver. Then, just before the All-Star break, he zipped in 41 against defending champion Boston. Every time he played Bird, he thought of the disrespect the Boston star had shown him during the Olympics exhibition tour. During warm-ups, Jordan's ball had rolled down to the NBA player's end of the floor, where Bird scooped it up. Instead of throwing it to a waiting Jordan, the Celtic star tossed it over his head. "Bird was showing me it was all business and I was beneath him," Jordan said of the incident. "I didn't forget." Celtics boss Red Auerbach knew a showman when he saw one. "You can see it in his eyes," Auerbach told one interviewer. "He is happy when he sees a crowd out there and he can perform." Boston's legendary center Bill Russell agreed, saying, "He's one of the few guys that I would pay to watch." Band. As the rookie caught fire in early 1985, Nike released its first Air Jordan shoe, a red and black model that drew an immediate ban from the NBA. The league's guidelines called for players to wear white shoes, and the NBA said Jordan would be fined $5,000 each time he wore the new shoe. Nike's Rob Strasser and Peter Moore immediately phoned Sonny Vaccaro. Both Rob and Peter said, "Fuck 'em." "That's exactly what they said," Vaccaro recalled. "I said, 'What do you mean? We're going to do it without him wearing the shoe on the court?'" Strasser quickly decided that Nike was going to have Jordan wear the shoes anyway and that the company would pay his fines each night. Plus, they were going to tell fans about the banned shoes through an ad campaign. The NBA couldn't have handed the shoe manufacturer a better marketing platform. "When you tell the public that something is banned, what does the public always do?" Vaccaro recalled with a laugh. "Tell them you're not allowed to do something, and they'll do it." Nike moved quickly to take advantage of this gift horse, building the shoe's popularity on the fact it was banned. "And then it happened," Vaccaro recalled. Jordan's early play, along with the ban and subsequent marketing, sent sales soaring. Nike would ring up an astounding $150 million in Air Jordan sales over the first 3 years, which in turn brought Jordan the first wave of profound personal wealth. For that first season, Nike pushed hard to make Air Jordan products available for the All-Star Game in Indianapolis, Vaccaro recalled. "We made red and black everything, wristbands, t-shirts, everything in the Bulls colors." That All-Star weekend of 1985 would long be remembered for the flashy rookie with the fancy new outfits and for how some of the league's veteran stars engaged in a freeze-out of Jordan during the main event. The alleged collusion was so subtle that at first even Jordan failed to recognize it. The story broke afterward when Dr. Charles Tucker, an advisor to Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, and George Gervin, talked about it at the airport. Tucker told reporters, "The guys weren't happy with his attitude up here. They decided to teach him a lesson. On defense, Magic and George gave him a hard time, and offensively, they just didn't give him the ball." "That's what they're laughing about," Tucker explained to the media as he stood near the stars waiting to fly out of the Indianapolis airport. George asked Isaiah, "You think we did a good enough job on him?" Their reaction had apparently been triggered by the rookie wearing his new Air Jordan jumpsuit at the slam dunk contest. Jordan, bedecked with gold necklaces during the event, lost in the finals to Atlanta's Dominique Wilkins. Tucker revealed that the veterans also thought the rookie seemed arrogant and standoffish. Thomas had supposedly been offended when Jordan had little to say during an elevator ride to a player meeting the first night of the weekend. "I was very quiet when I went there," Jordan later explained. "I didn't want to go there like I was a big-shot rookie and you must respect me." For the All-Star game itself, Jordan had played only 22 minutes and taken just 9 of the team's 120 shots. Agent David Falk explained that Jordan had been asked by Nike to wear the prototype of the Air Jordan clothing. "That makes me feel very small," Jordan said of the snub. "I want to crawl in a hole and not come out." Asked about the incident by reporters, Isaiah Thomas denied any freeze-out of Jordan. "How could someone do anything like that?" the Detroit guard said. "It's very childish." Asked later for comment about the freeze-out, Bulls teammate Wes Matthews said, "He got gifts from God. He's God's kid. Let him be God's kid." In retrospect, Vaccaro saw the incident as a backlash against Nike by athletes who earned comparatively little from Converse. "Nike was the enemy," he explained. "It was Nike. We created this guy. It was Nike. It wasn't so much he appeared in the dunk contest and was a fan favorite. Dr. J was a fan favorite. Nobody got mad at Dr. J. It was what we did with him." Dr. Doctor. Few saw at the time the immense power that Jordan was acquiring as a result of his captivating play and his Nike contract. Jordan himself would acknowledge that the incident made him realize that the game's established stars were against him. It planted the seeds of his dislike for both Isaiah Thomas and Magic Johnson. The feelings against Thomas intensified with their two teams competing in the league's Central Division. Jordan's dislike for Johnson grew after word reached him that the Lakers guard had apparently encouraged team owner Jerry Buss to trade his old friend James Worthy after Los Angeles lost to Boston in the 1984 championship series. "The incident was gasoline on the fire of Jordan's competitiveness," explained Vaccaro, who had begun spending substantial time behind the scenes with Jordan. "That became his personal crutch," Vaccaro recalled. "That's why we watched this person turn into the killer on the court that he is. He took them all to task. He never forgot that day. He's smiling today and he's kissing with everybody and all that stuff, but he never forgot that. That was the first public snubbing of Michael Jordan. Do any of those guys today remember that? Does anybody admit that? When he got the snub from Isaiah, who was a great player obviously, Michael took it and made it a thing he put in the back of his mind." The Pistons were scheduled to play in Chicago Stadium the first game after the break, and Thomas chafed when reporters asked about his involvement in the freeze-out. "That never happened," Thomas said. "I was very upset when I read that. That could affect a potential friendship between Michael and me." Before the game, the Detroit star sent a message to Jordan that he needed to talk. Granted a brief meeting, Thomas apologized in person, a display that Jordan later termed mostly show. At night, Jordan scored 49 points with 15 rebounds to help the Bulls to a 139-126 overtime win. On one breakaway, Jordan clearly paused, giving Thomas just enough time to run into the picture before throwing down an emotional dunk, which the game's broadcasters immediately identified as taunting. Afterward, Thomas again grew angry with reporters. "It's over, it's over," he told them. Far from over, their personal confrontation would play out over the ensuing seasons as the Bulls battled to overtake the Pistons in the Eastern Conference. The heightened competitiveness was just one of many changes afoot. During the All-Star Game in Indianapolis, the men who had owned the Bulls for more than a decade revealed their plans to sell the controlling interest in the team to Jerry Reinsdorf. Reinsdorf told the press that the transaction would be consummated about March 1, 1985. Jordan and his Bulls suffered through a 12-game road losing streak down the stretch before closing out the season with 35 wins, an improvement of 8 over the previous year, and good enough to make the playoffs for the first time since 1981. But with their front court thinned by injuries, the Bulls lost to Milwaukee 3-1. "As the year went on and we made the playoffs, Michael just got bigger and bigger with the fans," assistant coach Bill Blair recalled. "I remember the trip in Washington where we won to secure a playoff position. 2 days later we played Philly, but Michael stayed in Washington and went with Senator Bill Bradley and made an appearance in Congress. Then he got on the plane and flew up to Philadelphia that night. He had the shoot-around the next day and got 40 against Philly. So you knew Michael could handle all the other stuff outside of basketball and still get it done." The loss in Philadelphia left Jordan winless in 5 attempts that first year against Julius Erving and the Sixers. Long known for his classy approach to the game, Erving had not been implicated in the All-Star freeze-out, even though he too endorsed Converse. But Sixers coach Matt Gukas wondered about the effect of the Jordan hoopla on the very proud Erving. First as a broadcaster, then as a Sixers assistant, and finally as head coach, Gukas had been able to observe Dr. J's career up close for more than a decade. "I saw Doc from all those different perspectives," Gukas, who had also played alongside Wilt Chamberlain on the Sixers' great 1967 team, recalled in a 2012 interview. "Julius was mesmerizing as an individual, and the stature he gave our organization, the way he was looked up to, the way he treated people was just magnificent. He always seemed to have time for everybody, no matter who they were. And it was genuine. Julius was coming to the end of his career when Michael was just starting to blossom. But you know, I think there was a mutual respect there between the two, and Michael was always very, and I don't want to say careful, but he always made sure that he recognized Julius for the star and the person he was, what he brought to the NBA before Michael, as somebody who brought the wow factor to professional basketball. And I think Doc appreciated that. Michael unfortunately didn't get a chance to play against Doc at his peak, but I'll tell you what, there were a number of games I saw them play against each other. Doc more than held his own, and on a number of occasions got the best of the situation. It was never a one-on-one matchup. It was always a team deal. But Doc would always stick his nose in there and have a little extra hop in his step every time we played Michael. Those great players, they didn't want to be embarrassed. They knew that if they went out there with just an ordinary effort, like it was just another of 82 games, Michael could make you look bad, real bad. So they were always ready for the challenge. Gukas admitted that he too had fallen under the sway of Jordan's aura in those early seasons. The Sixers coach recalled that he was obsessing about Jordan in the locker room one night before a game at Chicago Stadium. "The locker room in the stadium was dark and dank and just awful," Gukas recalled. "But the arena was great. It was my favorite place to play and be in. I remember we were getting ready to play. It was in a back-to-back situation, and I was trying to make sure our guys were ready to go. I was going on and on about Michael. Doc kind of like had his head down and he was sort of fiddling with his sneakers or whatever. He finally looked up. He'd had enough of it. He said, 'Hey, wait a minute. We can play too, you know.' I said, 'You're right. It was a good lesson to learn. Enough said.' I didn't need to be going on about how great he is," Gukas recalled with a laugh. "He and Andrew Toney went out and beat the bejeebers out of Michael that night. Julius would invariably end up matched up against Michael at some point during those games. Doc kind of gave me that look after the game. He still had a little gas in the tank." Part 6. Flight School. Chapter 17. The Young Prisoner. Dean Smith had suggested that Jordan take a communication course at North Carolina to help prepare him for interviews and public appearances. He had some awkward, hesitant moments during his NBA debut, but that was to be expected. He could get by on poise alone and would enjoy excellent relations with the media over the course of his career, even when they annoyed him. Almost overnight, local TV and radio stations that once had little interest in the Bulls began showing up to cover the city's newest star. He was so articulate, former Chicago sports TV producer Jeff Davis explained, and he photographed like a charm. Jordan's fame exploded quickly from there, starting as a splash of Nike commercials and highlight footage, which in turn fed enough word-of-mouth momentum to drive a craze. Bulls PR man Tim Hallam watched Jordan mature into a remarkably self-possessed public figure. Julius Erving had brought a grace to the role of pro basketball superstar that Jordan admired and emulated in his relations with the media. It also didn't hurt that Dolores Jordan watched her son's every move and was in his ear if something seemed amiss. Furthermore, his ability to listen meant that he understood reporters' questions and routinely formulated engaging answers. "I think he grew in every way," Hallam observed. "If you look back to his early interviews, he wasn't as articulate as 4 years or 8 years or 12 years down the road. You know, everything changed about him. Everything he wore changed about him, too. It's funny to go back in his first year and see what he was wearing, and then go 4 years from there. He went from sweatpants to designer suits." As positive and profitable as the public spotlight was, it also hastened Jordan's alienation, a process that Hallam began to notice by February of that rookie year. Some of it had to do with his mushrooming fame, and some of it stemmed from the humiliation of the All-Star freeze-out. Sonny Vaccaro flew to Chicago to talk with him in the aftermath of the freeze-out, to explain the reaction of the league's biggest stars. "After the All-Star game, no one at Nike knew what to do," Vaccaro recalled. "Michael and I talked. I told him, 'This shows you the depth that they're going to go because you're better than all of them, Michael.'" The talk did little to alleviate the disappointment. Magic Johnson had been his hero. As Jordan told reporters, the incident made him want to crawl in a hole and hide. He was already rapidly on his way to becoming a prisoner in his hotel room, unwilling to venture out in public outside of games and scheduled appearances. Only occasionally would he emerge from his isolation, Tim Hallam recalled. "It was like, 'Wow, Michael's out.' You were happy for him. Meaning, it's kind of like a lion getting out of the cage and walking free within the boundaries of the zoo for a while." Beyond the apparent rejection by the league stars, the pressure of such sudden stardom was overwhelming, and a large part of Jordan's new life that could not be avoided. Teams still flew commercially in those days, which meant that road life began early in the morning with 5 o'clock wake-up calls and immediate exposure to a public that recognized him at every turn. People simply felt compelled to approach the sports world's newest magician, and it usually wouldn't take long before he was mobbed, Hallam explained. "I would say, 'You know what? He's got to just say the hell with it and go about what he wants to do.' But then you find out when you see him come out like that he can't, because people would go so gaga over him, whether it be an adult or a kid or whoever, they couldn't hold themselves back. They'd lose their fucking minds. That's how it was for him." The situation sent him looking for refuge. "Michael used to talk about going to a movie theater," Joe O'Neill explained. "You go sit in a movie theater, you're just like a regular person. Aside from that, restaurants, malls, the gas station, anywhere you go, people are going to be all over you." Nike and the NBA itself would ultimately bear some of the responsibility for the sacrificing of Jordan's private life, observed George Gervin, who became Jordan's teammate in 1985. "That's where it changed everything, man. They made him bigger than life. That made it tough on him. They made him the most famous guy to ever play. But that's a tough life where you have to have a guard with you everywhere you go. You can't eat. You can't sit down without somebody sitting around you. He had that Michael Jackson kind of life. That's a tough life, man. That can drive you to an early death. And the game was changing. How ESPN and cable TV came in. He really had to isolate himself because they promoted him so hard. And Nike and all them promoted him so hard. It made it hard for him to be just a regular guy. You get robbed of your life. Trying to deal with the public just got to be too much," Tim Hallam recalled. "I think it was just a change in that the demands were pretty incredible. And you've got to remember the demands were incredible just from the Bulls side of it, let alone his own ventures and commercials and Nike and life in general. All of it together was chaotic, especially at that time in the NBA. Longtime Chicago radio reporter Bruce Levine perceived that Jordan came to feel objectified, much like a very beautiful woman who can't get by the fact that people focus only on her exterior, because people are so taken by what she is on the outside and what she is physically. He knew that people didn't deal with him as a person, but as an object. "He had a lot going on," Hallam said. "I don't think it really changed his personality, but it made him a different person because he had to be different. You can't satisfy everybody. You may try for a while, But then you learn that, you know what, I can't do this and it's not worth my energy to try and do it. And so certain things are going to fall by the wayside and certain people are going to think that it's because, you know, I have a huge ego or I'm big-headed now or I have money or fame now. That simply was not the case. There's only 24 hours in a day. I think that was the biggest thing that I saw that I felt bad for him, in that no one could control that. And yet, Hallam added, he still went out and did what he was supposed to do. Caught in the struggle. Strangely, Jordan found some relief around the regular reporters covering the team, people whom he had come to trust enough to chat with before games. He also continued to draw support from his family, with his mother and brothers making regular visits to Chicago to stay with him. His father visited too, but that created its own problems, because of the growing conflict between his parents. Soon, people involved with Jordan and the team in Chicago began to notice that they rarely saw his parents together. Sonny Vaccaro pointed out that after those initial meetings, it seemed he almost never dealt with James and Dolores Jordan together. At first, it would be normal on the trips, Vaccaro recalled. They'd be together. When it first happened, we had a meeting together, but then, after a time or two, the lines were drawn in the sand. I can't honestly say that I remember more than a one-sentence conversation with him together after that. And the Nike staff members felt some relief at that. They could always rely on Mrs. Jordan to be professional. You trusted Dolores Jordan, Vaccaro explained. She was an impeccably dressed, very educated woman, whereas James was crude in a way. Still, they were in business with his son, and Nike officials soon found themselves dealing with the father, a task that Vaccaro disliked. James Jordan was known to drink, he said, and time would show that he was unreliable in business, as shaky as Dolores Jordan was solid. Sis, Michael's older sister, pointed out that the parents had fallen into their own intense competition to influence their son. Her father was quiet and reserved, while her mother moved into the spotlight, she explained. Though his sudden popularity brought with it a resounding level of success, it also brought an avalanche of contention between my parents. As with her marital conflicts a decade earlier, this new conflict could erupt with surprising intensity outside of the public's eye. Michael was split between his parents from day one, Sonny Vaccaro explained. I mean, not to the public, but there was this contemptuous relationship. Mostly the parents had competing views of what Jordan should be and how he should conduct himself. The son loved both his parents, felt a loyalty to each, and somehow managed during his first few years to keep their conflict from reaching toxic levels. But as his career advanced, that became increasingly harder to do, Vaccaro said, an opinion shared by the family's older daughter. James Jordan's own life was far from perfect during his son's first season in Chicago. The father was going through the humiliating process of dealing with his criminal charges in North Carolina, and Sis had made it known to her parents that she was exploring legal action against both of them in connection with her sexual abuse allegations. She had checked herself in for psychiatric treatment at a Wilmington hospital. No wonder James found easy escape in the fantasy life his son was living, no matter how confining the circumstances. Bulls employees and fans alike took notice of the closeness between father and son. James Jordan presented an amiable, low-key figure. The media and Bulls staff members enjoyed his constant good nature, and as he had done when Michael was in high school, James made it clear that he was not there to meddle with the team in any way, but only to help his son's adjustment off the court. Michael adored him, former Bulls assistant coach Johnny Bock recalled in 2012. They were like buds, you know, Tim Hallam said of Jordan and his father. I thought that was kind of nice. He was always with him. He always hung with him. I think it was good for Michael. Yet in many ways, James's companionship only served to intensify the tension with Dolores as they both sought to influence their son. Not everyone saw or felt that conflict. Joe O'Neill recalled spending time with the Jordans when the Bulls went on the road. I remember sitting in the hotel lobbies with James and Dolores Jordan. Their attitude was, "We'll get there someday. You know we will." They were always very, very positive and supportive. Mike's dad was a funny, funny guy, a jokester. Dolores, she was like everybody's mom. She looked over Michael like any mother would. She was as sweet and nice of a person as you could imagine. She never had any air about her that, my son's a superstar, or whatever. Michael's parents were protective of him, very, very proud of him, just like regular parents. Posse time. A number of other people took up residence in Jordan's young life, beginning with Nike executive Howard White, a former University of Maryland basketball player who also happened to be African-American. Howard was like his guy, Vaccaro explained. He was a basketball player. Howard was a good person. He was his companion on the road, too. The entourage expanded from there, Vaccaro explained. That's when Michael got the North Carolina group back up. Rod Higgins remained close. Michael started forming his own posse. All of that was starting to happen. It was a revolving group with an understood mission of keeping Jordan company on road trips when his hotel room began to feel like a prison. The agenda included card games, golf, mixed drinks, pool, whatever it took to lighten the mood. This group soon came to include old friend and teammate Adolf Shiver and the three Freds, Fred Whitfield, who soon had jobs working with Nike and David Falk, Fred Glover, an insurance adjuster who had met Whitfield and Jordan at the basketball camp back in Buies Creek, and Fred Kearns, a Charlotte mortician who had often golfed with Jordan. That first season, James Jordan was alarmed to get a large bill for the expenses the entourage had run up while they stayed with Michael for an extended road trip. I first thought it was a waste of money, until I thought about it a little longer, the father said at the time. Then it occurred to me that it was in Michael's best interest to keep close friends around him instead of strangers. These guys were good for Michael. Other regulars in the early days included Buzz Peterson and Gus Lett, a former security guard at Chicago Stadium who assumed some of those duties for Jordan. But it was George Kohler, Jordan's driver and impromptu valet, who proved especially constant and reliable over the years, Joe O'Neill explained. George has been the perfect kind of buffer for Michael. With a guy like Michael, you almost always need somebody with you, somebody to run a little interference, to have another set of eyes out there for you. George is a great guy. He's a Chicagoan. His and Michael's relationship is very, very special. Michael didn't have a big entourage. His closest friends were kind of regular guys, Rod Higgins, Adolf, the different Freds. Those in the entourage soon took to calling Michael Black Cat because he could pounce as quickly in a social setting as he could in any game. Jordan seemed driven by an insistence on challenging those around him in even little ways. His verbal gamesmanship was conducted at a level that seemed worthy of anything he did on the court. With his friends and people who are close to him, Jordan will see something and ride you and crack on you, Rod Higgins once explained. To deal with him, you have to go right back at him just to make the night not so long. He seemed to enjoy back-and-forth banter as much as he relished a good game of one-on-one, and he approached it with the same mentality. He's the kind of guy, Tim Hallam explained. If he comes at you, you've got to go right back at him. You've got to be able to take his hits, his barbs, if you will, and come right back at him. Otherwise, you're a dead man. The best way to get him is if you throw it back at him and people around him are laughing. Then he kind of backs down a little bit, because you've let him know, I've got some shit too, okay? As Hallam explained, Jordan believed his team should go 82-0 each and every season. He carried a similar level of expectation into his social life, which didn't make it easy to be around him. If you make a mistake, he'll let you know about it, Buzz Peterson once pointed out. Hallam added, it's kind of like you have to be competitive with him too at whatever, or one, you're either discarded, or two, you're no fun to compete against. Sometimes his companions had to make sure they weren't too good at coming back at Jordan. He hates to be embarrassed, Whitfield once explained with a laugh. He can't take that. He can dish it out all the time, though. If he's gonna tease, you gotta volley, Hallam said. He likes to volley, but you have to do it in the right way. You can't be bullshit, and it's gotta be good. Would we yell at each other? No, but he'd say something like, you know, I could get you fired, and I'd say, hey, don't do me any favors. You think I'm enjoying this shit right now? This hard edge was also tempered by the childlike nature that George Kohler first observed. Jordan displayed a vulnerability at times that contrasted with the fierceness of his competitive persona. Early on in his new life in Chicago, he showed much of the complexity that would come to define his personality. For starters, he wrestled with intense and complicated emotions about his family. He prized trust, and when he found it, Jordan was capable of almost staggering displays of loyalty. Once you are friends with him, he really works at keeping that friendship and nursing that friendship, Rod Higgins explained. Conversely, if that trust was violated or he sensed some affront, his response could be just as intense, a factor that he had learned to channel into his competitiveness. Perhaps the most important thing to all of his friends, the thing that kept them traveling back and forth at their own expense to hang out with him, was the uncommon loyalty. Jordan was able to communicate to all of them that he cared about them. What people don't understand, said former teammate and longtime friend Charles Oakley, is that he really is a good guy. And without doubt, there was the sheer joy and fascination of being an insider in Michael Jordan's lofty world. The view from those heights was exhilarating for those around him. He was basketball's Elvis. He created this mythology for all of us, Vaccaro explained. Whether it was Nike, whether it was me personally, whether it was his friends, whoever it was with him, the small group of guys that he had with him, that the ones who had gone up and down with him, they were his friends. They were the only ones he could trust for 8 or 9 years. So they made themselves useful as friends, and then something more. For example, Adolf Scheiber, Jordan's oldest friend, filled a role as something of a mouthy social director and bartender for the gatherings. Mostly, Scheiber brought the feel of home to the group, along with a sixth sense for the party atmosphere and a humor about Jordan's limitations. "That boy don't know how to make drinks," Scheiber once said of Jordan. "He'd just be throwing shit together." The reality of it, said former Bulls psychologist George Mumford, was that if he hadn't created that cocoon, he probably wouldn't have won those six championships. Juanita. By far the most important addition to Jordan's private world was Juanita Vannoy, whom he met in December of his rookie season. They were introduced by a friend who set up a meeting at a Bennigan's in Chicago. A few weeks later, the friend had a small party to give them a second opportunity to spend time together. Vannoy was a beauty, said to be one of Reggie Theus's former flames. She was almost 4 years older than Jordan, and he immediately found that appealing. It challenged him to raise his own level of maturity. He found that he could talk to her, as he could with his mother. This ability to talk led to something of a magical connection, and they began spending more time together. As Lacey Banks of the Chicago Sun-Times explained, Jordan's existence had quickly become that of a young prince, so it probably helped that Vannoy had already dealt with a Chicago player who was popular with the ladies. By all accounts, she was classy, intelligent, and patient. She was self-confident and low-maintenance, both critical to managing a relationship with Jordan. "Both my wife Pam and I found Juanita to be a lovely person," recalled Sonny Vaccaro, an assessment echoed by Jordan's golf partner Richard Esquinas. "I knew Juanita from day one," Joe O'Neill offered. "Juanita was a great person. I grew up in the south side of Chicago like she did. For whatever reason, it all never seemed to go to her head. She always seemed the same Juanita that I always knew." Nonetheless, Jordan's parents did not approve of her and spent some effort at trying to counter her influence, according to Sonny Vaccaro, which might explain in part the on-again-off-again nature of the relationship over Jordan's first years in Chicago. Truth be told, no one figure, no one factor was likely to distract Jordan from feeding the competitive monster inside him. That ate up a substantial portion of each day. His main outlets were basketball and golf, although not always in that order. Fortunately, his fix required nothing elaborate. In the early days, when Jordan was still figuring out what to do with himself in Chicago, he would often drop by the Bulls' offices, where he, Hallam, and O'Neill had set up their own miniature golf course. "We'd play putt-putt," Joe O'Neill recalled. "We'd put together a little 18-hole golf course in the office, and we'd bet. We'd walk around the office putting golf balls into waste cans, and that son of a gun, he was as competitive playing putt-putt in the office as he was on the court. He'd take $20 from me, and that's when $20 was like $400. I still remember giving him $20 in the office, and my wife yelling at me for gambling with him." "When the weather was good, they'd take it outside," O'Neill recalled. "We played public golf courses. We played at Medina Country Club. He was about as good as I was at the time. Then he started playing about 150 rounds a year, and he became a very good golfer. But when Tim and I first started golfing with him, Michael was just taking up the game. He could hit the hell out of the ball, but you never knew where it was going." Jordan often talked of how he prized the solitude of the course. However, his unrestrained joy didn't exactly make it peaceful. "He never shut up," O'Neill recalled with a laugh. "He talked when you're swinging, talked when you're putting. He could be a great commentator on TV someday if he wanted to. He could just mentally give it to you, whether you were putt-putting in the office or out playing on the golf course or shooting a game of pool. He would always ride you. For the few brief hours, he could be Mike Jordan, regular guy. That's why golf became so important to him," O'Neill said. "It gave him some solitude away from people. He said the golf course and the movie theater were two places he could get away from people, where he could go like he was anybody else." That spring of 1985, Jeff Davis was producing a regional golf show that featured celebrities playing around with baseball broadcaster Ken the Hawk Harrelson. Once the season ended, Davis contacted Jordan about appearing on the show, and he jumped at the chance. "He came on, and he couldn't have been happier than to do this," Davis recalled. "Of course, Jordan asked for 3 do-overs. He wasn't satisfied with his showing," Davis said with a chuckle. "There was no money on the line. It was a matter of pride, and he wanted to beat Harrelson, who was a terrific golfer. He couldn't get closer, but he looked nice. He had a nice swing for a guy that size. Golf is not a sport made for the tall man anyway, but Jordan was bound and determined to succeed at everything." The scenes were shot on a course in Chicago's north suburbs that day, and after the shooting was finished, the crew packed up their van and headed back down into the city. It was about an hour from downtown, Davis recalled, and we were coming back down the Edens Expressway, driving along. All of a sudden, our cameraman was driving and said, "Geez, there's this Corvette that's flying behind us. And here comes this car, it pulls right up beside, and it was him. He's grinning ear to ear, just laughing, and then he just gave a little wave of his fingers, and bam, he was off again and gone." Chapter 18. The Foot. Jerry Krause got the call during spring training 1985, when he was working as a scout for Jerry Reinsdorf's Chicago White Sox. Reinsdorf wanted him to come to Chicago to talk about running the Bulls. The conversation went well, considering that Krause had already been fired several years earlier as the Bulls' GM. Krause had bounced around for years scouting in baseball and basketball until he found his way into working for Reinsdorf and the Sox. Reinsdorf had grown up in Brooklyn, where being a Dodgers fan was almost a religion, he explained. He was a dutiful follower, along with every other kid on Flatbush Avenue. Reinsdorf also loved the New York Knicks, especially Red Holtzman's teams of the early 1970s. Later, after he had finished law school and begun amassing a fortune in Chicago real estate, Reinsdorf seized the opportunity to own sports teams, first the White Sox, then the Bulls. Learning of his boss's admiration for the Knicks, Krause was no fool. He soon took to regaling Reinsdorf with tales of his days competing as a scout against Holzman. It was the early 60s, Krause's first year in scouting for the old Baltimore Bullets. Other scouts in the business were already making fun of him. He was dumpy and short and looked nothing like a scout or like anybody who had anything to do with athletics. He was also secretive and wore a trench coat and hat, like Inspector Clouseau. They called him the Sleuth and snickered behind his back. Everywhere he turned, it seemed Krause was running into Holzman, who was scouting for the Knicks at the time. Early one morning, they happened upon each other in an airport, and Holzman asked Krause where he had been. "Down the road," he replied. Krause loved recounting what happened next. He looks at me and he says, "Son, I want to tell you something. I know where you've been, and if you've got any brains in your head, you know where I've been. So let's cut the bullshit and let's be friends." Friends they became, even as they competed fiercely to find hidden gems among the available college players. Krause thought he was about to make the steal of the 1967 draft with a raw-boned young forward named Phil Jackson out of the University of North Dakota, but Holzman snuck in and stole him for the Knicks with a 17th pick. "Fuckin' Holzman," Krause had muttered on the day of that very special draft. Scouting for the Baltimore Bullets, Krause had set the table for Baltimore to take Winston-Salem State's Earl the Pearl Monroe with a number 2 pick, and Holzman had picked Walt Frazier out of Southern Illinois with a number 5 pick. Both players would wind up in the Hall of Fame, as would Jackson, as a coach. Holzman went on to coach the Knicks to 2 NBA championships, with Frazier, Monroe, and Jackson all playing a role, along with guys like Dave DeBuscher and Bill Bradley. And Krause made his way as a scout, all the while battling the snickers and naysayers who seemed to question everything about him. In the process, Krause built the kind of knowledge that would impress a no-nonsense man like Reinsdorf. When Reinsdorf bought the Bulls that spring of 1985, he had thought he might keep Rod Thorne as director of the team's basketball operations, but the Bulls went on a losing streak, which prompted the new owner to feel out what Krause would do to improve the team. "First," Krause said, "he would get rid of the bad apples. The way I figured it, we had a whole bunch of Fords making Cadillac pay," Krause recalled. "It was selfish. Everyone was playing for themselves. Next, because he knew a thing or two about spotting college talent, he would use the draft to make the Bulls a team with a future. They would stop signing bad free agents." Reinsdorf liked the draft philosophy and trusted Krause as a scout. Krause said the first player he would look for would be a tough power forward, a banger to protect the basket and the Bulls' shiny new star. Beyond that, he would attempt to draft athletic players with long arms. Finally, he said, he would find good jump shooters to make opponents pay when they double-teamed Jordan. Just as important, he would look for solid citizens. Chicago had to clean up its history of bad eggs. After the talk, Reinsdorf realized he had to fire Rod Thorne and bring in Krause. "Krause was atop the scouting hierarchy at the White Sox, and I had gotten to know him," the owner explained later. "There had to be a cultural change in the Bulls organization, and Krause believed the same things I did. In time, they would become known in Chicago as the Two Jerrys, the men who held sway over the Jordan era with the Bulls. I want a team that will play red hole.